From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Coach Onandy Show. Later in the broadcast, a new gun deal in Virginia. Some say it's a good example of bipartisan compromise. Others say it's a downright betrayal. We'll talk about it. But first, the Bureau of Land Management is not often in the news, but we are a month into a standoff in a wildlife refuge in Burns, Oregon, and the central issue of the armed occupiers is the taking back the land now overseen by the federal government. The situation highlights some of the many misconceptions about the federal land and the Bureau of Land Management, starting with who owns the land and how it can be used. Joining us to discuss this is Neil Cornsey. He is the director of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. He joins us in studio. Neil Cornsey, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
You can't talk specifically about the ongoing situation at the wildlife refuge in Burns, Oregon, but I'm curious about the role of the Bureau of Land Management and the oversight of public lands in general. There are a lot of misconceptions about the land that the Bureau of Land Management oversees. People call it federal land, but that's not really accurate, is it?
Yeah, so I think that's a great place to start. You know, when people use the term federal land, I think it sounds somewhat distant. When I think of federal land, it means it's your land, right? Public land, it's owned by all Americans, and it's managed by agencies like the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Forest Service, on behalf of the American people.
This wildlife refuge is one small part of a vast amount of property. The Bureau of Land Management oversees some 250 million acres, and that's just above ground, starting with those surface acres. Can you talk about that land and what the Bureau actually does?
So we have a very broad mandate. We manage resources in every single state in the country, but the majority of the surface land that we manage is in the western states west of the Mississippi. So everywhere from, you know, the shores of the Arctic Ocean all the way to the Mexican border, we have oversight for oil and gas development that takes place. Private companies come in and lease areas. They pay for that right. We make sure it takes place in the right place at the right time, and they pay a royalty. There's 16,000 ranching families that we work with that graze their cattle across the West. There's thousands of mountain biking trails and millions of mountain bikers. There's families going out to explore. There's people hunting and fishing. And really, it's very robust. There's a lot of public land out there. And you name it, people are trying it and adventuring out there with it.
If you have questions or comments for Neil Cornsey, call us at 800-433-8850. What do you know about the public lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management? You can also send us email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation there. What land do you manage here in our region? We're sitting on the edge of Rock Creek Park, but that's managed by the National Park Service. So could you make a distinction between what your agency manages and what like the National Park Service manages?
Yeah, so we don't manage a lot out in this direction. There is a facility down near Lorton where we have a barn and a few thousand acres that people use for taking their horses out and for riding. But you had talked earlier about surface management. So you can actually divide property into surface and subsurface. And so most of the parks or refuges or even some of the tribal reservations around the country, the Bureau of Land Management has responsibility for managing the soils or the minerals underneath. So we have a footprint that's about 13% of the surface of the country, but the footprint of the subsurface or the minerals and soils is about 30% of the country. So it's quite significant in this area, but it's a little complicated, so folks aren't as familiar with the agency in the eastern United States.
As I was about to say, very few people on the East Coast have much of a relationship with the lands you manage. You grew up in Nevada, but the major part of the U.S. population is in the East, but the vast majority of public land is out West. Do you think we here on the East Coast have a different relationship, if you will, with public lands?
Well, I do think it ends up being different. Yeah, if you live on the East Coast, you might understand the public lands from an occasional family weekend where you go visit a battlefield or a historical site or even a national park. And it's probably fairly occasional. You know, my experience in the West, you know, my parents were working at a gold mine that was on public lands. In the evenings, I was out, you know, hunting or bopping around on my mountain bike, you know, out on the public lands, which surrounded the town that I was in. And it's an everyday experience, and it's part of your work, it's part of your play, and it's really central to the existence of a lot of Western communities.
A lot more intimate relationship, if you will.
Very much.
2 years ago, in a related situation to the Oregon standoff, the father of one of the current occupiers, Cliven Bundy, was involved in a dispute about grazing cattle on public lands. You were involved in negotiations there. For many of us, especially here on the East Coast, the policy of private ranchers grazing on public land is not well understood. How many people graze their animals on federal land, and how does the whole system work?
Yeah, so there are about 16,000 different allottees or grazers or permittees that are out there grazing their cattle on the western lands. They pay a fee. They pay to have their cows on the public land. And, you know, it's a system that by and large works very, very well. They help us keep eyes on the lands. They make sure that we have, you know, properly functioning ecosystems out there. We work with them on rotation of those cows to make sure that that's done in a way that's responsible and that's protecting the natural resources. But by and large, we have fantastic relationships all across the country with those grazers. There are a few folks who have popped up in the news here and there, but they're significant outliers.
Are there often disputes about access to public land or disputes about fees owed?
So we rarely see disputes about fees owed. When folks are alerted that their fees are late, they usually correct that problem right away. So in terms of access, we are very proud about being an open access organization. You know, I think in states like Montana, there is a rigorous public dialogue about the fact that people want more access, but actually it's private land that they're concerned about. There might be public land on one side and public land on the other side, but they can't reach it unless the private landowner is willing to open a gate. So those are some of the debates that we get involved in.
Our guest is Neil Cornsey. He's the director of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. Taking your calls at 800-433-8850. What do you think of cattle grazing, mining, and oil extraction on public lands? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Interestingly, the Cliven Bundy situation was triggered in part because the Bureau moved to protect an endangered turtle, and the current standoff is taking place in a wildlife refuge. What role does the Bureau of Land Management play in protecting habitat and endangered species?
Well, let me give you a brief background on the Bundy situation in southern Nevada. So this gentleman, Cliven Bundy, has been illegally grazing his cattle on public lands, your lands, for more than 20 years. Three different federal judges have stepped forward, issued orders for him to remove his cattle. He's refused. The judges directed us to remove the cattle. That's what we attempted to do 2 years ago. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife works on species issues more than we do, more directly. We manage a lot of the habitat, so that's where the intersection comes, whether it's desert tortoise or the greater sage grouse, which we recently had a major victory on in terms of making sure that bird, which is across 10 different western states, did not end up getting listed under the ESA.
But in the Cliven Bundy situation, it's my understanding that he owes a lot of fees. What's the distinction between being allowed to graze on public land for a fee and not being allowed to graze on public land at all?
So there are some areas, in all of the areas that we regulate and oversee, there are places where things make sense and there are places where things don't make sense. And so, you know, there are many areas in southern Nevada where it's simply too dry, there's too many uses, and so grazing is no longer appropriate. In terms of Mr. Bundy's situation, he stopped paying his fees. And so when you're no longer paying the American people the rent that they're due for the use of the public lands, then you're no longer allowed to use them.
We got a tweet from someone who said, how would states be able to afford large public land holdings, or would they? Because Some of these protesters would like the land to be given over to the states.
Yes, yeah, so there are significant costs to undertaking this management. And, you know, there's a conversation in some states about should it be federal, should it be local, should it be private. And I'll tell you, my own personal experience of growing up in the West was the access was so fantastic and so significant. You know, I could go in any direction and be out on the public lands and take advantage of what was there. And I would hate to see that taken away for future generations.
Some history, perhaps. How did the Bureau of Land Management come about?
So it's a very long history that goes back to the very earliest days of the country. States like Maryland and Virginia were in a contest as to what should happen with the lands west of the Appalachian Mountains, just not far from here. And a deal was brokered that essentially the lands west of the mountains would belong to the federal government, and they would be used for public benefit. And in the early days, notably in 1812, when the General Land Office, the predecessor agency to the Bureau of Land Management, was created, the government land office was stood up. They sent teams out. They would survey 6 miles by 6 miles and mile blocks in between, and they would sell it. And then they kept marching west. So really it was manifest destiny is the history of the organization. And things changed over time, and it led to the 1970s when Congress and the president decided that the lands that were left should be kept in the public trust. We'll stop selling them. We'll manage them for the public good forever. And so these are the working landscapes that we now have and now are part of the public trust.
Bureau manages 250 million acres, we mentioned this earlier, of surface land. But in terms of the land we can't see, how much of that land underground does the Bureau manage?
So it's very significant. It's almost a third of the country where we're managing the mineral resources. So that could be coal extraction, that could be oil and gas, that could be gravel. So it's very broad ranging, and it's in the east, it's in the west. If you're seeing federal lands, more than likely the Bureau of Land Management has responsibility for the minerals underneath.
700 million acres is the estimate that I've heard about underground land that you also manage?
That's right.
We got an email from Barry in Ashburn, Virginia, who asks, please ask your guest to clarify whether there is some federal land other than what he identified as public land. For example, are the White House and the Pentagon and Air Force bases federal land that are not public land?
So that's a good question. So public land actually is a specific term that's frequently used to apply to areas managed by the Bureau of Land Management. But more broadly, I would use it to apply to the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, the U.S. Forest Service. But the Department of Defense and Department of Energy also have holdings out there. Those are places that, although managed by federal agencies, usually are less accessible.
We've heard something about the grazing policies on public land, but something that may surprise listeners, and you mentioned this earlier, the energy production that takes place on the subsurface land, and in particular, in terms of energy production, you in particular have focused on solar energy. Talk about that.
Yeah, so this has been a great accomplishment of this administration that prior to 2009, there were zero solar facilities that have been sited on public lands. And so since then, there's been approximately 30 large solar arrays that have been approved for public lands. A number of them have been built, and to the tune of, you know, some of them are a $1 billion investment, and they are producing significant amounts of power, gigawatts of power that's going on to the Western grid. And really, this is the future of energy production in this country, clean, renewable energy. Very exciting to be part of that.
Here now is Rob in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Neil. It's good to talk to you.
Hey, Rob.
My question is, I wonder if it's time to deal with the hundreds of areas that the Bureau of Land Management identified for study as wilderness that have been languishing in Congress for decades now, 35 years, and use the executive authority that the president has, granted by Congress, and make them national monuments. Hmm. I mean, talking about more than 500 acres, millions of acres.
Good. Well, Rob, this is a very important issue that you've raised. So one of the things we haven't talked about that the Bureau of Land Management does is we manage some very special protected areas where Congress or the President has stepped forward and said, conservation is the highest and most important purpose on this landscape. And so we've got places like Red Rock Canyon outside of Las Vegas, places like the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument in southern Utah. And there are actually about 800 of these areas, many of which are wilderness study areas, which Rob mentioned. And Rob, one of the things that I'm excited about and I encourage Congress to do all the time is to have the debate, to go on the ground, look at these areas, and as communities and as delegations make decisions about where wilderness should be designated and areas that may not be appropriate. But it's something that the last few decades we've seen quite a bit of progress, and I'd like to see even more.
Thank you very much for your call, Rob. We move on to David in Potomac, Maryland. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
The question that I have is whether minerals that are extracted from government lands and farmers who are leasing government lands, whether both or groups of people are paying market rates, and how frequently are those market rates reviewed?
Neil Carnes.
Yes, very good question. So we have a responsibility to everyone listening as Americans that we get fair market value for the use of the public lands. And so that's written into our Organic Act, and that's something that we take very seriously. So in most programs, there might be a reevaluation on a five-year clock. Sometimes it's sooner, sometimes it's later. But those are some of the questions that we're engaged in. You know, the Secretary and I, Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, and I announced a few weeks ago that we're taking a hard look at the coal program. 40% of the coal that's produced in this nation is harvested off of public lands. It's very important that we are getting fair market value for the American taxpayer. And so it's been about 30 years since there's been a hard look at the way that program works. We're going to do a full evaluation to answer the type of questions that David raised.
Thank you very much for your call. We got a tweet from Travis, who says, one of the biggest arguments for the land grab is to take back the land, but it was never state land in the first place, correct?
That is true. So as we talked about earlier, looking west from the Appalachian Mountains, it was almost all federal territory, public lands that belonged to the American people. And so this concept of taking the lands back, in many cases, is a conversation about people wanting to privatize lands and take it from being accessible and available to all Americans to being accessible and available to just a few. And so I think you can understand the importance of those issues to us in making sure that people have open access and they have the type of experiences that I was able to get growing up in the West.
What's the role of public land in mining, oil, and gas production?
So there's quite a bit of oil and gas production and mining on Western public lands. So you'll see absolutely enormous coal mines. You'll see large gold and silver and copper mines. And, in the going back to David's question, in most of those areas, there's a royalty that comes from the production of commodities off those lands. That's actually not true when it comes to hard rock mining. The 1872 mining law has not been fundamentally changed, and there was no royalty built into that. So that's one of the oddities, and it's a debate that comes up from time to time.
Speaking of the 1872 mining law, that's what Charles in Fort Washington would like to talk about. Charles, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. How are you?
He's well.
Great.
Okay. You mentioned the 1872 mining law, referred to it as an oddity. My understanding is that it not only allows individuals and private corporations to get access to subsurface hard rock minerals like gold, silver, copper, at less than market rates, but it also allows them to obtain ownership of the surface at much less than market rates. Would you speak to that, please?
Yeah, so it is Congress has had a rider since the mid-1990s that has stopped the privatization of lands for mining. So that used to be the case. You used to be able to go out, stake a claim, which literally was just putting some posts in the ground, and then working that land, paying your fees, and then you could privatize it. Now at this point, you can stake your claim, you can work that land, but you're going to be working on public lands because Congress has put a stop to that system.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. We got another tweet from Travis who says, huge concentration of Native American cultural history on BLM lands. What does the BLM do to protect that heritage?
Oh, that's a great question. There are so many amazing cultural artifacts out there and so many wonderful tribes that we work with. There's about 550 tribes across the country, and we take very seriously our responsibility to have strong government-to-government relationships with those tribes. So coming from the desert Southwest, where I'm from, you know, one of the things that always blows my mind is the ancient rock art. You know, you could be hiking out of the middle of nowhere, come across a rock panel that's got 1,000-year-old inscriptions. So these are on the public lands. We work with site steward programs to make sure that people are out there making sure that graffiti and destruction isn't taking place, and making sure that we're working with local tribes to have an awareness. But we're also very cautious to make sure that we're not advertising the location of these places, because they are special and in many cases are sacred.
Here now is Robert in Manassas, Virginia. Robert, your turn.
Would you comment on your decision to sell nearly 1,800 wild horses to one individual who subsequently sold them for slaughter in Mexico?
So Wild Horses and Burros is one of the programs we haven't talked about. And it is a unique situation in terms of the way I talk about it is three types of wildlife in this country. There's animals that are not endangered, and those are regulated by governors, by states. There are animals that are endangered or threatened and are on the endangered species list. Those are regulated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then the third column is wild horses and burros. In the 1970s, Congress decided that the Bureau of Land Management should have responsibility for these animals. And so we've been working very hard over the years to do a good job managing that population. That population now is twice what it was in the 1970s. We have about 50,000 horses on the range across the country. And there's actually another 50,000 horses that have been removed because they've been overpopulated in certain areas. We are housing and feeding those horses many times in the Midwest to a significant cost to the taxpayer. It costs about $50,000 over the life of many of these horses to take care of them. They are available for adoption. And for those listeners out there that have the capacity and the interest, we would strongly encourage you to look at our Wild Horse and Burro Adoption Program. And in terms of making sure that horses get to a safe home, which is what Robert was talking about, we have put in place a policy to make sure that the maximum number of horses that a person can adopt, can take in a six-month period is 4 horses. And that's because a professional trainer can train up 4 horses over a six-month period. And so these are wild horses. They do need to be trained if they're going to be in a domestic situation. So that's how we came to that calculation.
What's the specific incident that this individual is talking about involving 1,800 Mustangs being sent to somebody who sold them to Mexico for slaughter?
Yeah, so there's a gentleman who was there's an adoption system and then a sale system that Congress created. This gentleman purchased a number of horses, made verbal commitments to us that he was getting them in the hands of responsible owners. And there's been an investigation that pointed to the idea that many of the horses ended up in slaughter. So it's something we've taken very seriously and led to some of those policy changes I was talking about.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Neil Cornsey is the director of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kajo. Great to meet you.
Going to take a short break. When we come back, a new gun deal in Virginia. Some say it's a good example of bipartisan compromise. Others say it's an outright betrayal. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at WAMU.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.